Would you consider yourself the leader of the band at that time?
You know, in my memory, I do. I wonder what they think. You know what I mean? Like, for real. Like,
there's no more true statement about being in a band than I wonder what they thought about that time period.
Yeah, because in my mind, I was a huge piece of moving things.
In this episode, you'll get to know Josh Scott, the Willy Wonka of guitar pedals, and you'll hear the story of how he went from being a college dropout to becoming an industry leader and tastemaker for musicians around the world. I'm Dave Crenshaw, and this is My Success Project. Welcome back, friends, to the Dave Crenshaw Success Project. This is a show where I'm interviewing people, some of the successful people I've met throughout my life's journey, and I want to get their story so that I can teach my children how to be successful. I'm looking for universal principles of success, and you get to come along for the ride no matter what your age is. In case it's your first time here, I'm a best-selling author. I speak around the world to Fortune 500 companies, and I've taught millions of people how to be successful through my online courses. And this show is about something a little different. I wanted to create a legacy for my kids so that they could look back at it, they could learn from it, and they could hear these stories and find ways that they can adapt those stories to their life. And I want you to look for ways that you can do that as well. So as you're listening to this interview, look for one thing in particular. Look for something you can do. Not something you're going to do a year from now or even a month from now, but something you can do this week based on the story that you hear from my guest. And my guest, oh wow, he's got such an amazing story, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. Josh Scott is a guitarist and the owner and founder of JHS Pedals, a worldwide guitar effects company. Josh also educates others on music technology and history through his JHS show that happens on YouTube and other places. I've watched it. It's really entertaining. He also lectures and speaks at live events worldwide. He lives in Kansas City, Missouri with his family, and enjoys exploring the history of music technology and sharing it with his followers. So his YouTube channel has over 400,000 followers, and he has over 300,000 Instagram followers. But most importantly, he's sold hundreds of thousands of guitar pedals around the world and counting. Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you being here.
Yeah, great to be here, man.
I'm really enjoying your stuff. I was looking on YouTube and watching some of your videos, and I love your laid-back sort of wry humor approach to everything.
It's a mixture of watching every episode of Seinfeld like 25 times through and just learning to not take myself too seriously. Yeah, all I can do is be me. So just try to have fun, and just here I am, you know. That's been the motto the last several years, is like, all right, this is me.
Yeah. No, I love it, because that's what people want now.
Yeah.
We're so jaded, we're suspicious. We don't like things that are overly polished now, and so we see somebody who's just a genuine nice guy who your knowledge level is tremendous, and we'll get into that. But when we see somebody who's genuinely an expert, who's behaving like a genuine human being, I think everyone gravitates toward it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm so drawn to just like honest people. When you get into business, you know, after a decade or more of business, you learn, like, you can spot the weird stuff. You can spot the weird personas, and like stuff doesn't line up. And so I think the more I've gotten into it, it's like I've felt more and more freedom to just, you know, this is where I'm at. And if I'm going to sustain this, I really need to stop trying to be somebody else. So that's been the last few years for sure.
That's a great principle. So what did you want to be when you grew up? I'm talking about, you know, as you started to get into your teenage years and started to form ideas, what was your career that you had in mind?
Yeah, not this. The first memories I have some childhood stuff, which is very typical, you know, kind of the same old. But I remember one of the very first things that when I started thinking about what I wanted to be, I think it was based out of how It was like how I started seeing the world, you know, options. Because I grew up in Northwest Alabama in a really small kind of rural farming area. Like my town is more of a township, a stop sign, you know, a gas station, a high school, and like 10 Baptist churches, like just a very southern, like,
okay.
Yeah. So, you know, that I remember one of the first moments thinking, because I had this thing in me, it was like, I got to move on from this, you know, like I want to do something bigger than this. And I got really into the idea of maybe being like a park ranger and like going and like working in a national forest. Or like, because to me, you know, because growing up like
yeah.
that, it was like, okay, I grew, you know, we used to raise horses and stuff. And I was like kind of on a farm. I was like, but that's the other world out there, a park ranger, like a government job. And then that kind of
nice.
Went away. But that was like one of the first memories. I think it became... I got really into sports. I'm 6'6". So, you know, if I walk into the elevator,
oh, wow.
you're going to go, you play basketball? Like I've heard that my whole life. So I did get really into basketball. I was pretty like being a pro ball player. I was pretty rational. Like I knew that the chances of that were like astronomically low, but I think it really was music when I got a guitar. So, you know, 15, 16, music gave me an ability to see the world that I had never been to. I would be looking through records, you know, I would hold like a Radiohead record or a Pearl Jam record. And I would be like,
is that who you're listening to?
Yeah. 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 Like I would hold that Pearl Jam record and go, what is Seattle like? And I would actually like get an encyclopedia and stuff and like study the cities. Like I was so interested in the world.
Interesting.
So I would look through album covers and I would like look at the photographs and be like, okay. And I've actually, you know, now that I've done this job and been able to travel, sometimes I'll actually go and find the photo on the album cover and like just imagine what that was like as a kid thinking about the standing in the place. That was really it. I mean, for me, it was, I wanted to be a creative. I wanted to be a musician. And at that time, I was going to be a guitar player. I was going to be in a band. I was going to be a rock star. That, you know, that's...
And other than the albums that you were looking at, was there any kind of influence in your life at that time? Or were you seeing anybody nearby? Or were these just dreams that you had in your own head?
Yeah, really small town. So I mentioned my town community. So if you get on the highway and you drive 10 minutes, you end up in the nearest city. That city's pretty small, but there was a little guitar shop and the guy that ran it, he was in a band and this guy's like in his 40s and they let me and my band that I had, we'd come and watch them. It was just so wild, like to go walk in and these adults who were like accomplished, playing really good music, they're exemplifying what I see myself wanting to do. That was like the first situation of that. And to be frank, because I was from such a small community, that was kind of it. You know, there wasn't a lot of people to look at that were doing what I saw myself wanting to do. Because what I wanted to do was big, but I was from that small town. So it was pretty hard to find local, like, say, mentors or people like that. But that was definitely one situation where I was able to see. I'm such a visual learner. I struggled in school. I'm not a good book classroom learner. But if I want to learn something, I'll get the books and memorize them and I'll put myself through the paces and I'll figure it out. But it was always hard. It was really hard because I could never find anyone doing the big thing I saw myself doing.
And this was happening what time period? Are we talking the 90s?
Yeah, yeah, mid late 90s. Yeah. So I'm 41. I was born in 82. I graduated in 2000. So my high school years are like those late 90s, 96 through 2000 years.
And so then you went to school. What did you study?
So I had a music scholarship and I went to college and I just literally was miserable. I was traveling with my band. We were like playing. I was just putting it all into the band. And so I have a solid like, I would say 1 year of college and then I dropped out. Yeah. So I just couldn't do it. Yeah.
Well, and your story is an entrepreneurial story, which we're moving toward here, but that is not uncommon. As someone who's coached hundreds of business owners, I can tell you that most of them, the way in which college took place, the structure of it just did not work for them.
Yeah. That's definitely
that.
Yeah. I just wasn't into, you know, it sounds like immature and weird when you hear it at first passage, but you know, I wasn't into what they were trying to teach me. It's like, I really struggled with, I was so passionate about other things, and that was such a battle for me. And I think there's a difference, and I'm having to learn this in my own kids. That didn't mean I was really driven and I worked really hard, but I just didn't want to work on what they wanted me to work on. I saw something that wasn't in the path. Like, school had this path. My path was over here, and I was willing to, like, hell or high water, do that work. This was just wasteful, and it's such a contradiction in what I was trying to do.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the band for a bit.
Yeah.
Because if you've been through it, I'm going to start by saying I had a band for a couple of years. I tried to be a rock star. I tried to, you know, get a label and all that.
Cool.
While my wife supported me. So this was early 2000s. Was that about the time you were doing things, or?
Yeah, it would have been nine for me. The like serious, you know, playing shows at showcases and A&R stuff. Yeah, it'd be like 99, 2000. Yeah.
Okay, so you were a couple of years ahead where I tried to do it. What's interesting is there are so many things about business and success and relationships that you learn in a band setting. Can you talk to me about the impact? Let's talk about, first of all, just like the people that you were associated with, the impact that they had on you in this early stage of your career.
Yeah, I think the band members, it was such an interesting thing for me, because my family environment, my brother's 10 years older. So like, I'm kind of an only child. If you do the birth order thing, like, he was so far removed, he literally moved out, you know, when I was 8. So when I get, you know, I'm in this band and we're all in it, man, they're as dedicated as I was. I always felt like I was still pushing. I was so driven, you know, I was probably got on their nerves. But
and sorry, what was your role? What, you played guitar? Were you singing? Were you writing songs?
Yes. Singing, writing, guitar. Yeah. So we were like a classic 4-piece rock band, 2 guitars, bass, and drums. Yeah. And I think the biggest takeaway looking back, and that's a great question that I kind of have never necessarily thought of. It's like that element of teamwork is wild. Like, looking back, it was such an initiation. Now, as a business owner with 40 plus employees and 15 years under my belt of all this and creative teams and collaboration, man, it's so wild how much that was college. Like, that was a college course you don't get, is you have a drummer, a bass player, and another guitar writer, and you have to work together. You have to be excited about each other's ideas, and you have to be rational about them. You have to figure out how to be disciplined and show up on time and keep each other accountable. And you have to have fun or you're going to be miserable. So that's a huge lesson. That's such a valuable thing.
That's such a good point about the fun aspect of things. I actually wrote a book called The Power of Having Fun.
Cool.
But it's really, really easy as a musician, because it seems from the outside like, oh, this is fun, this is relaxed. You know, what a, I don't know what the word, it just sounds a little passive, but it is a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
To try and get gigs and the pressure of money, which does not exist. I made the comment, and this kind of deals with your industry, but I made the realization in my band that there are more people making money selling things to musicians than there are actually musicians making money.
Yeah, it is. It, you know, we're trying to make it. If you know, you get into music history and economics of music and industry, it was kind of the final era too of bands making a ton of money off their actual records. So there's like all this weird stuff shifting. I remember actively using things like LimeWire and Napster to figure out songs and then go buy a CD. Like, downloading music was new. You know, and now, now we're in the world
posting it up.
Yeah. 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 And now we're in the world of like, I will never forget seeing some of the first Spotify stats for like Pharrell's Happy, which was streamed like 50 kajillion times and he made like nothing. There's like that weird thing. We were in an era where we're trying to get a record deal because the record deal, and there's rules, and that record deal is going to pay your salary. And now all that got really broken, and it's like most bands make most of their money off merch, or like, it's crazy. Like, it's such a backwards world. So that pressure cooker,
yeah,
of a band, we were trying to run a business that played songs. Like, I think that's really bizarre. It's a super bizarre thing.
Well, and especially like you said, at that time period where we hadn't quite gotten past CDs, mm-hmm. there, I mean, it wasn't that long ago.
No.
It seems like forever ago, but you know, we're talking 20 years ago, and there was no streaming like that. You right. had to sell it. It was hand-to-hand combat. Talk to me. The other thing that's really interesting is now you're a business leader and you work with employees, but the personalities in a band are usually strong personalities. That doesn't mean that they're loud. What I mean by that is, like, if you've got an introvert in your band, he's a really an introvert. And if you've got somebody who like loves the attention, he really likes the attention. What did you learn about dealing with different personalities that helped you now as a business leader?
Yeah. It's such a crazy thing to unpack. It's a great question. I mean, I think back on my band. My band was me, who was like crazy driven. Like, I was, we're doing rehearsals, this, this, and this. I'm there early. Let's all be there early. We're going to approach, you know, there's like strategy to even like writing, just very methodical and very driven. But also creative and ready to try whatever. The drummer was very, like, very driven. And then I felt like, you know, our bass player, he was, like, along for the ride, which was kind of awesome. He's, like, just a totally, almost passive personality. And then my best friend was the other guitar player. So we had this interesting friend dynamic. And he and I would write a lot together. Yeah, it's interesting just to, I'd have to unpack that. I mean, there's a lot to the threads of those workings and like actually remembering it properly.
Would you consider yourself the leader of the band at that time?
You know, in my memory, I do. I wonder what they think. You know what I mean? Like, for real. Like,
there's no more true statement about being in a band than I wonder what they thought about that time period.
Yeah.
Because nobody really communicates clearly.
Yeah, because in my mind, I was a huge piece of moving things forward. But I also, I'm honest enough to be like, I wonder if they kind of felt the same. You know, I wonder how that felt in there. And it's 20 years ago, right? I actually don't even know that I would like myself if I met myself 20 years ago. Like, would I get along with that version of me? Yeah, so it's obviously skewed. It's a little skewed.
What was the name of the band?
At that time, it was Caliber. Calibr.
Okay. And would you say that you were on a pathway to success? I know for me, and I'm asking this because I know for me during that time period, if I look back, I was a bit delusional. I don't think that we were as close to having success as I was thinking we were and saying we were. What's your perspective on it? Were you guys actually like, did you get a record deal? Were you close to that?
How far did it get? Yeah, we were really close. We had a lot of interest. We were doing very well. Like, locally, meaning the local area, when you're in the South, local is big. So I'm from that small community outside of the small town, but that small town is outside of Muscle Shoals, which is like a very famous music town in Alabama. And, you know, there's places to play there and such. And there was a musical legacy because of the huge and famous recording studios in the area. And there were connections. And we did really well, say, you know, locally and regionally. And we had begun recording. We'd gone through a couple of recording processes. And yeah, I mean, I would say we were. And again, with all that I know now and what details I probably am missing from those memories, I think we were. But, you know, it's like perspective. Nice. Have I remembered it entirely correctly? Probably not. But I think we were doing pretty well.
And for how long did it run? And then what was, I'm assuming you guys aren't playing together anymore.
No.
So how long did it last? And then what led to the eventual falling apart, which can happen a variety of different ways? What led to that, that kind of pushed you more toward the path that you're on now?
I hit a point in late 2000. So we lasted about 4 years total as we were, a really good, solid 4 years. I just was done, and I started the path of, I just want to be a producer. And
okay. Why were you done, though? Why, like, say, I'm done with this?
I felt like, for me, yeah, this is great. It's a great exercise. You said you were a therapist, so. We're walking through this.
Well, I'm a coach. I have lots of years of executive coaching, but sometimes that comes out.
No, it's awesome. So, it's awesome. Yeah. I feel this through all the stuff I do. Even I deal with this even now at 41. When I hit the point of, this was the first time, this band is a really awesome, what you're asking me is a really cool layer I've never quite thought about in this way. I had gotten as far as it was going to go, and I knew it. And that was enough for me to leave. So in myself, I was really interested in producing my own music, doing my own music. I wanted to play on records. Like, I wanted to do session playing. I wanted to do whatever. And so I just went and I did that. I walked away from the band. I still have good relationships with pretty much everyone. I walked away from it and I just went a different path. And they continued on. The drummer, they did a Nirvana, not that we were Nirvana, but the drummer took my spot and they got a new drummer. So he was a great guitar player, writer as well. So they kept going for several years. I walked away from it and I just completely went a different path. And ironically, about a year later, I got married and literally moved. So it was like this pretty violent shift of everything that had nothing to do with why I left, but leaving that band, the trajectory, the people I met doing the other stuff, I ended up literally relocating and married my wife, you know, so it was like a wild fork in the road for me.
So what was the eventual genesis, the beginning part of JHS Pedals?
Yeah, the genesis of this company was, I'm a guitar player, writer, I'm producing records, I'm whatever. I'd built like those early iterations of home studios. I was totally one of those guys, like rigging stuff together and like, you know, tracking records where I shouldn't have been able to. Now it's very easy. You can record a major label record on a MacBook. But back then it was like rigging all that stuff up, getting into it. But I had pedals, I had a pedal board, and I had a foot switch. Basically the activator of the pedal, the switch, broke, and I took it apart and I fixed it. And I was just like, I just became obsessed. I'm very fixated. I'm very trying to be kind to myself. I'm just very like over the top and highly high. When I get into something, I'm just like fully into it. Obsessive, I guess.
Let me pause you on that for a second, because that sometimes is a hallmark. There are a few atypical mental patterns that could fit under. I know for me, you know, I've been diagnosed with as being off the charts ADHD, and that can be one of it. Is like, if you're not interested, there's no way you can get interested. But if you're interested, you're really interested, and you lock in on it. Is that part of your perspective, diagnosis, anything like that?
Yeah, I wonder a lot. As I've gotten older, my best friends, they're incredibly like this. I feel like I gather similar people around me where we are highly obsessed about things that no one cares about. Like, just like really, really obsessive. And I think, yeah, there's something to that. I've never been diagnosed with anything, but like it would not shock me at all. You know, I should go check it out because it'd probably be helpful. But I'm very
clearly you're functional.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a highly functioning something. Like, yeah, I can tell that there's definitely motivations and drivers. Like when I'm fixated, I will drive you nuts if you're not ready to, like, if, you know, it's in my company or my wife or what. My wife is like, can you not have a hobby? That's her favorite statement. You know, like she says it lovingly and she doesn't mean it in a negative way. It's just like my hobbies are always me mastering the thing and then and then moving along. Like I'm okay. done. And it's like the extent of mastery is why, like, insane. I will do anything and everything, and I will go for years fixated on something. And then when I feel like I've mastered that thing, I'm very bored and I need a new thing. My entire life is just, I'm motivated by learning the new, learning at a deep level. Like, I can't do it casually. There's something about the mastery of a thing that really excites me.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it and I identify with
yeah.
it. Okay. So you start to obsess about these pedals, right?
Yeah.
So where did it make the transition from fixing to creating?
So I fixed this foot switch on a pedal. And you're probably familiar with like a Boss pedal, like a very common classic Boss guitar pedal. Okay. You know, there's just a
yeah.
mechanic. And inside of it, there's a little switch.
We used a lot of wah
yeah,
in our
yeah.
band.
So a foot switch and a pedal is essentially you stomp the metal box and underneath where the foot pad is in this model of pedal, it's pretty much the same mechanism that's on your computer keyboard that just it's a button. It's a little momentary button that's activated. So I fixed that whole thing and learned how the circuit worked. Then I went, huh, I had two of the same pedal, but one of them had been modified by a guy. So it was a modified pedal. So I took both apart. Got a notebook, and I literally, without knowing what a resistor was or a capacitor or anything, I started writing down what did he do? What's different? I did a what's different. It was like the child version of spot the differences in this picture. You know, it was like I did that with the two pedals. And then at that point, I found myself at a Radio Shack because those existed. I'm old. And I was finding the parts he had used, and then I took the parts out of the other one and I matched him. I did it. I copied his mod and modded the other. So scenario for a viewer or a listener would be like, you have a modified car or something, whatever. Like you take the same car and you figure it all out and copy it. I was doing that with the pedal. And that was just more fuel on the fire because I started learning like, oh, this is the transistor. It's an amplifier. It has three okay, this is how this works. This is what a capacitor does. This is what a diode does. And I just started really going down the rabbit hole. I was getting schematics for like pedals that I'd always used, and I was making them from scratch. And then I started going, oh, well, all these circuits is kind of like cooking. It's like, you know, everything's a cheeseburger sort of, but you can make a cheeseburger like a million different ways. And I started like playing with like in my head, a distortion circuit is essentially there's an input, there's an amplifier, there's a distortion piece, and then there's tone. And I just started learning all those things and playing Legos with it all. And then I made my own effects.
Did you have any inclination? You didn't mention anything about this prior to this point. So did you have any previous experiences with like engineering no. or circuits or anything like that?
No, not at all. No. Huh. I had no idea what a resistor, I had no idea. So I go, this is me, you know, this is my wife's first experience with me in this world. I get so into this. I'm like staying up at night. I went and bought a couple college textbooks on engineering. I'm like highlighting college textbooks. I'm writing down stuff. I'm like, I'm so far into this rabbit hole. It's like I'm drowning in it. And then I start with, because I'd been doing these mods to other brands, I was like, I'm going to go down to Guitar Center. I'm going to buy several of this one model and I'm going to mod it up and I'm going to put a sticker on it And I had no creative name, so I used my initials, Real Genius. But I put the sticker on it, and a local store just started selling them like hotcakes. Because it was more of like a hobby. It was like, who doesn't want some side cash, right? But for me, it was fun. So I was like, I'm just going to see if I can sell a few of these.
What was that conversation like? Like, what? Because the hardest part for any entrepreneur is selling the first one.
Yeah, for me, that was like, he just saw what I was doing. And he's like, hey, let's like toss a few of these in here. And I just tossed them in. And when he sold them, he gave me some money. And I was like, cool, I'll just make more. And I kept making them. That was like, there was zero effort in that.
So I have a book called The Focus Business, and I compare entrepreneurial stories to superheroes. And they're different origin stories, right? There's the destiny story like Superman. There's the decision story like Batman. Yours is the accident story. It's the Spider-Man story, right?
Yes.
Like, you didn't set out to do this. It just, you got bit by the guitar spider, so to speak, and the next thing you know, you're selling pedals.
Yeah. I mean, and then I can trace back, you know, you asked me about engineering. No, I don't know where that is. I mean, I took a flashlight apart once or something, but I don't have any great story. There's no link there. What I do remember is I loved selling stuff as a kid. Like I loved it. Like I would do weird.
What did you sell?
Oh man. I got really into trading cards, and I would like trade up and cash out. I was doing like weird, not in hindsight. I'm like, how did I know to do this? But to me, it was like, there was a logical economic thing in my, like here's the path of profit. And it's like really bizarre because my family, like, you know, I'm from a poor middle-class working-class family. My parents, you know, there's nothing there that's like start a business. There's no entrepreneurial gene, so to speak. And I just have these memories of that. I remember like buying up mechanical pencils in third grade because they were like cool. And then I had the lead and I was like turning profits at break time, selling people like number 5 lead, number 7 lead, this pencil, these erasers, like weird stuff that in hindsight I go, where did I get that? Like, I don't know. I loved that. Business was like this game, and I felt like I had a knack for gathering what people didn't know they even wanted. I had this interesting, I don't know how to define it, and I don't want to like make it sound like I'm a genius, because it was just more of a like, I felt like I had an intuition about how to make people happy, and I could sell them stuff, and I don't know where that's from.
Yeah. Well, and I love how you just phrased that. Sales is making people happy.
Yeah.
In its purest and best form. And all too often, sales, because we experience people who are not trying to make us happy, they're just trying to extract money, there's a negative connotation for it. But I think part of your success, and even like when I watch the stuff that you do on YouTube, and there's this natural sense that's coming from you that's so genuine, that's like, I'm excited about it, and I'm trying to feed people who are excited about it.
Yeah.
And the sales just naturally come when you do that.
Yeah, I can trace that back, and I've thought a lot about that because it's bizarre. It's like bizarre once I got into business, and you know, without jumping ahead, I mean, one of my biggest things in business that I learned is like, I identified early on what I suck at and I quit doing it, but I was able to identify, I was able to let other people, I had a team, you know, I learned to delegate early. But what I did, what it helped me with is like, I'm okay saying what I'm really good at. And it's a few things. It's ideas and selling stuff. It's creating a thing and selling it. That's what I'm really good at. I'm really good at story and teaching, but don't ask me to do taxes. Don't ask me to, you know.
Yes.
Like, and I when I learned that early on, it was such a highlight to me to be more confident in the few things I'm really good at and like be okay saying that. Because I've always been timid. Oh. I remember struggling early. Like, the thing I don't like, I mean, I like it least of all, is just people who are just full of themselves. You know, I always struggled with like throwing the baby out with the bathwater and not being confident. I was always kind of scared to say, I love selling stuff and I'm good at it. Like, it was like horrifying for me to say that. But then I got over it. That's been really helpful.
So you were naturally following a principle that I teach and people struggle with, which is, I call it the most valuable activity, your MVAs. And it's two. I love that you just said that it's because I say there are two most valuable activities, and you just said it, ideas and selling stuff.
Amazing.
And what when you can focus your time and your effort on just those two things and get rid of everything else, that's where real success comes. So here's an example of you have such great intuition. So I also think that's one of your gifts, is there's some intuition there when it comes to sales and it comes to running a business, where you're naturally gravitating toward principles that are true, even if you're not fully, you know, you're not putting a name and a face to it.
Yeah.
It happens.
That's really cool to hear. Yeah.
So the first sale is a big milestone for entrepreneurs, and the first employee is also another major milestone. So who is the first person that you hired, or when did you say, I need someone else to help me do this thing?
Yeah. Early on, my wife helped in a way, and she would even be like, I wasn't the first employee, but you know, there was some help there. We had our first kid, and we knew we were very comfortable with, she, it was like, this isn't her thing. Like, she wasn't into, you know, it was fine. It was like, maybe my wife will be involved in this. And it was like pretty obvious, like she's gifted in other things and had her own stuff. So I did need help. And I was like, well, I have a really good friend I trust, and he's a quick learner. So I kind of trained him. I just needed help building stuff, you know, because you're building these pedals. This is where it got crazy for me. You have the idea, you're good at selling stuff, you're good at creating the thing. So I'm great at those. Then I have to suddenly learn to manufacture, like shoot me in the face. This is like where,
there you go.
Yeah. This is the like classic e-myth, you know, you start a bakery and then you end up not baking. It's like, that's the whole thing. This is where this started happening. But yeah, it was
technician turned entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Literally in this case.
Yeah. It was a good friend. I trained him, but you know, the interesting thing is, again, I was able to identify with some help. I did identify, like, I don't necessarily like making pedals. That was interesting. And I was able to admit that and not feel weird about it. I liked creating circuits, and then I liked making them look really great and giving them a story. And then I liked selling stuff. I actually didn't like setting and building them. So I think I was able to cut through some of the like stuff that I've seen a lot of people in my industry struggle with. In guitar MI industry, musical instrument industry, when you kind of start something and you're in the boutique genre, that would be a genre of like boutique, hand-built, high-quality, more expensive stuff. That's kind of where we are. I think there's this weird, I'm the maker and I have to make everything, and that's what makes it special because I touched it. I never had that. But I've seen friends
Thank goodness.
I've seen friends like lose their mind over this.
Yes.
And I'm always set on the side, like, why are you doing that? Like, you don't have to make that. You can, you know, I've just never struggled. I immediately didn't struggle with that. So I'm really thankful. So I started just training people to make the pedals with me, of course, for years. I built them for years. And then eventually I just never had to make them. I was able to create them and come up with them and then sell them.
And then I'm assuming you've created systems, processes, manufacturing tools that you have for this to make it easy for people to do it the right way.
Is that we're like a fine-tuned best practices hand, but like we have my leader, I have a core team of six, and that core team of six is over manufacturing, media marketing, HR, everything is automated. Everything is great. I'm a huge, huge systems person. Like, I hate if I have to touch something two times, I feel like it's a failure. And so I'm always like, what's the most efficient way? How do I not repeat myself? Because I hate repeating things. So let's train people well. Let's invest in process. And yeah, we've been able to do that here really well. So I'm thankful for that for sure. I have a great team.
Do you see a relationship between that desire to open up a pedal and create something new, and that's a process itself, right? The system of the circuits, and the system of creating systems, where you're opening up the way things are made and creating that. Do you feel that same sort of part of your brain scratching that itch?
Yeah, I would say a little bit, not as much, but what I do for sure is I can't ignore the need for it. It bothers me a lot. I might not get the same creative rush or like payoff, you know, but I feel like I can't turn away from, I know this has to be done this way or it's not going to be efficient. I do have there's an efficiency like radar that I've just kind of naturally see. There's definitely some stuff I don't love, like the nitty gritty of like HR and some of the nitty gritty of like bill of materials, parts ordering systems. Like, you know, for us, there's huge inventory down, you know, I'm upstairs here in our film studio, but like downstairs manufacturing, there's, you know, it's so many, there's a lot of minutia to how you build stuff. How do you order? How do you predict? I don't love all that, but I have definitely, it's been really great because along the way, even though I didn't love it, I knew it was necessary. So I did the work and then I found people who loved it and gave them autonomy and walked out of it. And so I just don't micromanage. That's bit me a few times. Like sometimes I should probably micromanage a little, but it's like, I've been the opposite. I basically am like, Hey, I'm doing this thing. I actually need like a manager. Will you just come in and like, how do you want to do it? Figure it out, make it great. You know, that's been my mentality. I've been really fortunate finding people. I have a really good success rate and it's just literally, I feel like it's luck.
You don't think that there's a system that you're intuitively following?
Probably.
It's hiring
yeah,
the right
probably
people?
So. It's yeah.
I mean, that's a system itself.
It is a system. I think I trust people well. I'm okay with mistakes because it means you're doing something. And I give people autonomy so they can create the job they want to have. I have, you know, there are things, and I think that draws a certain type of person because I've had to let people go who want me to hold their hand and tell them how much money they'll make in 24 months or something. Like, I don't know. You know, I'm just like, come in and let's build this together has been my mentality. So I think that does draw a certain type of person. And I have been really fortunate with a great team.
All right. So far, we've talked about all the good things. But, you know, I know that being an entrepreneur is to face a lot of adversity. And you kind of hinted at there's some times when maybe you made mistakes. Let's talk about a couple of times where you faced major adversity in the business. It was something that you had to overcome that you're comfortable talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah. No, I'm comfortable with really any of them. I'm trying to think of... My personality's funny because I leave stuff in the dust, man, sometimes, you know, but yes. It's even hard to define. I'm such a believer of even failures and problems are opportunities that I often like, I'm sitting here going, I'm trying to think of the worst stuff that's ever happened to me. But all of it has
yeah, great, one that you turned into an opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like all like, of them, I gotta figure you this know, out. You kind of have the choice. You can turn things into an opportunity and learn, or you just be miserable. So I've just always chose to not be miserable. I would say, you know, one of my problems I've had, this is me as a creative in this capacity, I got really into this idea of trying to be so original with everything that I like exhausted myself, literally spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on certain projects just to have them fail. And the ones that did actually come out, nobody cared. And I was so obsessed with being original because there was this pressure in my industry. Nobody does anything new. It's like, why didn't somebody do anything original? So I was like really feeding into that. And I think that was really a critical moment for me because there was a lot of failure in that, meaning products that never made it off the ground, money wasted, and products that were made that actually nobody wanted because they were too weird. So like, I learned a lot.
They don't want truly original, do they?
Nobody.
They want it to feel a little
original. They don't want. Nobody wants what they say they want. The customer usually doesn't know what they want. There's like a really, you know, the customer is always right thing. That's a very interesting, that's a whole other podcast, but it's like people in guitar, it's funny. So I like, you know, this is like a Stratocaster, classic guitar.
Nice. And for someone who's listening, he's pulling up a guitar and showing it to
you. I'm showing a guitar. This guitar was created in the 50s. And a guy named Leo Fender, he's responsible for kind of the evolution and the technology of a solid body electric guitar that was able to be turned up loud, which in turn created rock and roll, like really simple narrative. His first prototype was 1949. And it evolved into a guitar by 52 called the Telecaster, named after the television. So Telecaster, because television was new. And this guitar from 1952, if you go right now, start booking concert tickets all over the world for the next 30 days, go to a concert every night, you'll see a Telecaster on a stage 85% of the time. It was invented in 1949. Wow. It does not get better than that guitar for many reasons. And you can watch a metal band use it. You can watch a jazz guy use it and a country guy. The same is with all the electronics and pedals. So I make pedals. The first pedal was invented in 1962. And really, kind of everything that would happen ever happened in about 20 years. And then we get sparks of creativity around the basic idea of what was already made. But people always say they want something new in my genre, but they really don't, because electric guitar is pretty fixed. There's a sound, there's an expectation, and it's an interesting struggle. And I see a lot of entrepreneurs and business owners get really forced into some of this mindset that's hard for them to handle. You know, whether you're in tech, or tech is different and weird. Tech is so interesting. You look at something like Apple. What did it mean for Apple to innovate? Like, in a lot of ways, it meant that he just took away a bunch of unused stuff and, like, made a clean product. I think that's what Steve Jobs was so fascinatingly brilliant at. But I fell into that trap of, like, I must make the most original, unique stuff ever. And I learned hard lessons that were, that's not a good strategy. Originality isn't always what we think it is. It's not some great UFO falling from the sky. You know, it's really just, it's all about the story. It's all about the motivation behind the product, how it serves somebody. Does it make them happy? And you also lose this beautiful thing, which is, and I have a lot of friends that deal with this. You know, I have a couple of friends, they really struggle with, like, why should I make this product? There's like 10 of them. Well, you haven't made yours yet. Like, that's a huge thing. That was some hard lessons for me to learn, because I got real fixated on the originality thing.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And you brought up something, now I've heard it twice, so I want to highlight it. When you create a product, you said you're giving it a story.
Yeah.
And then you just mentioned the importance of the story. Can you explain what you mean by that? How does one give a story to essentially a metal box that's making different sounds when a guitar passes through it?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to maybe explain it, it's like one of my favorite subjects, but I think that when you look at brands you love, you rarely think about products. At least I don't. And I've asked a lot of people, you know, when I say Nike, what do you think? You probably see a swoosh. You probably think about Michael Jordan when you were a kid or something. I don't know. You're not right. Thinking about Dunk Low Max size 14 gray. You're not thinking that. You're not. Like, that's yeah. The product. If I say McDonald's, you see Golden Arches, Value Meals, and you see Grimace. But the point is, you know, Apple. I see Steve Jobs immediately. I literally see the dude immediately. I see... Yes. The look of the product as a whole. So there's this thing where brand is so much more important than your product. And people get so hung up on, is my product amazing? Sure, maybe it is, maybe it's not. But you cannot build a business on a great product. You have to build a brand. And the way to build a brand is you have to tell a story. And Nike tells a story. put our shoes on and you can jump really high. You can look awesome. You can fit into this segment and you're going to feel a certain way. Apple tells a story. Buy our computers and they're going to work and they're going to be exactly what you need technologically. They're going to be simple and we're going to offer some stuff nobody offers and you're not going to have to deal with the Windows menu.
And what's a story that you're telling with one of your pedal
so lines? Honestly, every product I think about it, I go, hey, here's this pedal. Let me tell you where it comes from. And usually for me, it's really fun. I'm like, in 1968, a man named Fumio Maeda invented this circuit out of this thing. He made it in Japan. Jimi Hendrix ended up with it on stage at Woodstock, et cetera, et cetera. This is my version of a famous circuit called the Univibe. And this is the story of that thing. And this is why it's important. So I launched a brand new brand 3 weeks ago. I found a brand from the 70s that I love that was dead. And I brought it back to life. So we've made a whole documentary. Mm. It's like a 2-year project. And I relaunched the brand. And the importance of the brand is the guy that started it. His story had never been told. So I did all the hard work of telling his entire story. And I told people, this normal guy made these exceptional, amazing products. And he changed the world. And so we're
this
offering...
This is the Ross story,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, Ross.
I was watching that just before this interview.
That's cool.
And I was, yeah, it was fascinating and it was interesting. And you're right. Now I'm like, oh, okay. Now I see these pedals. And if I were playing guitar, I'd be like, oh yeah, I want to try one of these out. I want to experience the heritage that's behind that.
I think it's like, you got to tell a story because that's what we have to see ourselves in the things we want to buy. Anything we buy, we see ourselves in it. If you decide to buy a Vitamix, you don't buy a Vitamix because you think it's cool. You actually buy the Vitamix because you see yourself every day blending smoothies in it, and it's going to change your life. But I mean, you have to remember, like, a Pet Rock was successful. Like, where's the brand? It went away. Mm. And in my industry, certain types of effects come and go depending on the weather. It's like, you know, certain sounds. They just like, who knows what's going to be popular? So if you base your company off of your product, you better hope that product is always cool or you're in trouble. The brand element, that story element to me is, I want people to see my brand, JHS, and I want them to know who I am and go, I relate to that guy. I relate to the brand. I like the history. I like the preservation work he's doing. I love saving these stories. And I think those products are really cool tributes to the past. And that's why I like the brand. And whatever product they put out, I know it's going to fall into those kind of genres of value. And I think that's what I've tried to build, because I think it's just so important for people to see themselves in my products, not necessarily just see my products.
I think everything that you just said there is the true genius of your business. I mean, yes, you're creating these pedals and you innovated those and that's valuable. But as I'm listening to this, I think this is really why you're selling so many. Do you know how many pedals you've sold so far, roughly?
Total? I actually need to do this math because I do these little staff talks every month and I was going to do a talk and I was going to add it up. So we're selling around the 100,000 pedals a year mark.
Wow.
We're up there. We haven't sold like a million. We're not that high up, but because the first years were pretty low. I mean, there were years 12,500 is like, which was huge at the time. I remember being like, who's buying all these? You know, 12,500. I remember 42,000. I remember 70 was crazy. And then I remember hitting 110 and just being like, this makes no sense. Where are these people at? You know, always. But I would say we're probably like 500,000-ish.
Okay.
Which is nuts. Well, like, I don't know where those people are. Like, you know.
Well, that's the power of aligning yourself with retailers, though.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
Yeah, for sure.
Because you don't have to know who they are.
I don't.
It's their job to find those people.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's also just a principle of success that, you know, I think a lot of times an entrepreneur thinks, I've got to sell it all myself. And you do sell direct.
No. Right?
No, it's all through retail.
I just committed to the engine of business to business because I think it outweighs. That's turning a bit in my industry. I'm keeping an eye and an ear on it. But to me, there were huge advantages to letting dealers do what dealers do.
Especially when you're an innovator, it's easier for you to focus on what you do. I mean, that's what I've done. I've aligned with LinkedIn Learning. I don't sell my courses direct. I partner with other places.
That's cool.
So I like that model. So I want to make sure we cover this before we're done. A big part of my message, and you know, I created this podcast. What inspires me is the idea of I'm going to find success principles to teach to my kids. And I especially want people who have balanced success. So not just, you know, a big bank account, not just conquering the world with you know, their business or entrepreneur, but people who prioritize having fun and making time for family and that sort of thing. I know that family is a big thing to you. What do you do to make sure that you maintain enough balance that you're giving them the attention that you want to give them?
Yeah, that's such an important question. And it's such an important thing for hard work, for entrepreneurs that work hard. You know, there's definitely the trope of like workaholic, you know, and it's real. It's real because if you're passionate about something, even though you're passionate about something else, man, there's such a danger. I love my family. I'm so passionate about them, but I have definitely found myself in the danger zone of they'll be okay. I've got to get this done, you know, and like, that's a tricky thing. I think some things I've done over the last few years that have been really helpful. The bigger we got, the more I came to grips with, I have to let more and more go, which I was already good with. I was a good, you know, I'm good at delegating and giving autonomy, but I had to really let some stuff go that was kind of sacred cows to me. One of the sacred cows was I just quit reading comments at all. So we have a huge social media, like huge. I'm setting at half a million YouTube, Instagram's huge for us, big numbers. I just quit. I had to quit. And dude, that alone was like nuclear. It was so good for me.
Quit, because not in terms of doing it, but just quit what, monitoring it, looking at it?
Yeah, I let someone else. I developed a position and gave them autonomy to figure it out for me. And they love doing it. Number two, it's not personal to them. Although they do, it gets personal because they love our company, you know, but there's a separation. Yeah. There's a healthy thing there. So I gave that to someone else and man, it's just excelled. It's gone way beyond me. Mm-hmm. I now feel confident enough to just make what I know I should make, put it into the world and move on. And I don't have to have people's opinions. I need to do, you know, you need to pay attention and not be a weirdo that's like, you have to see if people are engaging with your products. What I'm talking about is I can't worry about people not liking me or not liking something. Like, I need to move on. There's never been a person or a thing in the history of Earth that everyone has liked, ever. Like, it's never happened.
And what impact has that had on your family, that change?
Yeah, it's huge because when I'm home, I'm home. That was one of the things that was keeping me, my brain was not home.
Scrolling?
Yeah, looking, just scrolling or thinking or like, it just sends, you know, you're just, because it never ends. I mean, you get to a certain point, if you have any social media following at all, you can do that 24/7 and not even reach. You can't even skim the surface. It's a pool of nothingness. It's just not productive. It's not productive. It's useful. It has value, but you need to really weigh the value out and figure out within your organization, like you got to play a different game there at a certain point. So that along with, I got rid of my smartphone and I only use a smartphone at work. I have it next to me now. But when I'm at home, okay. I bought a phone. It's called Light Phone, L-I-G-H-T. And all it does is text and call. And so I just completely do other stuff. I've always loved to read. So now instead of scrolling or whatever, my book reading is like through the roof because I just read books. I hang out with my kids. I literally go on a walk, stuff that feels like alien in this age. I've just really committed to, you know, like this is the iPhone. So this is a work number now. And then I put my old SIM card in this thing. It's just a dumb phone. It's literally a little Kindle looking phone. That's been huge. And that's a practical thing. You know, I took the phone away from my nightstand. I charged my phones in the bathroom. I bought an analog alarm clock, like all kinds of stuff that's just like really quirky. But it works for me because I got really honest with my fixations and where I was spending time. And I just made a couple little adjustments that just kind of, I made it hard on myself. And it's been really good. I started using a notebook again.
Oh, a physical notebook?
Yeah, just stuff that, if it feels good, I started embracing it, even though it was countercultural. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I made the comment before when we were kind of dancing around the topic of mental health that you're highly functional. And I think even without any kind of diagnosis, who knows what it is, if it's anything, you are naturally creating systems and structure that recognize your limitations and you're building things around it to help you be successful. That is to me extremely healthy what you're doing. And it's fascinating.
That's really cool to hear.
Yeah, I'm sure your wife and your children really appreciate that. How old are your kids right now?
My daughter's 15. I have two boys that are younger than her. So she's my oldest. So 15, 12, and 8.
We're very similar in the path. 18, 14, and 10. So we're kind of in that same thing. And I think the example that you're going to be setting for your kids, especially as they enter those teen years, is invaluable because a lot of times we complain about kids being on phones and stuff, but it's really they're just following our example. They're just doing what we do.
Oh, it's so true. Yeah, it's super true. And those habits, it's wild, man. It's been so transformative to get my time back. And I'm careful when I share this stuff. Like I'm not anti. I mean, my whole business is an online business, and there's just a balance of like being honest with who you are. For me, I'm the most disciplined person you'll ever meet, but I cannot stop myself from wasting time on smartphones and stuff. And I just went, okay, so I got to figure that out. You know, just being honest.
That's fantastic.
And I think people are all different. Because I have friends that they don't have that problem. And I really do.
Well, we've established that part of your success is your obsession, but that is a double-edged sword. And recognizing that it can cut the other ways.
Yeah.
I love the solutions that you've come up with to protect yourself and your family from that.
That's cool. Yeah.
What is the story that you want to tell for yourself and your business a few years into the future?
No matter how fast-paced the world gets, no matter how complicated, no matter how amazing the tech is, and no matter if robots rule the world or not, guitar is a simple thing that connects to a human story. And it will always be the simple narrative that technology changed an acoustic instrument from the 19th century into a literal instrument that created rock and roll. Rock and roll changed people, and people changed culture. And so you're invited into this amazing history of changing sound. That's like, that would be it.
I love it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And I love your passion, your enthusiasm, your knowledge of what you sell. And it doesn't surprise me that you're so popular on social media because people want that kind of genuine approach. So, all right, here's what we do at the end of every episode, Josh.
Okay.
What I tell the people who are listening is it's not so much about the knowledge that you gain, but the action that you take on that knowledge. So what I'm going to do, Josh, I'm going to pull out three principles that I took from this, and I'm going to suggest three concrete, small, bite-sized action steps that someone can take. And then I'd love you to suggest, you know, one more principle and perhaps one action they can take. The idea isn't someone's going to do all of them, but they're going to do one of them. Okay, so the first one that I caught, and I talk about this with my son, I talk about this when I speak, feed the valuable obsession. If you have the tendency to be obsessive about something, like Josh has established he is, ask yourself, what is out there that people really want? that people will buy, will pay for. And if you're going to be obsessed, focus on something valuable. So for my kids right now, they all want to be writers. They're focusing on the valuable obsession of becoming writers. So one action you can take is consider, what is something valuable that I might be obsessed about? And if you do that, that's just going to drive you naturally to become successful. Then another principle is, and I wrote it down this way, rather than be original, innovate. And so you talked about how you wasted that time and the effort and money, and how people really don't want something original. But what they do want is innovation, which means you're taking something existing and you're making it a little bit better, a little more unique than what it was before. So consider something that, if you're an entrepreneur, consider how can you innovate on what you've got? Or if you're in a job and you've been working in the company, what's one little improvement that you can make to make it a little bit better and a little different than what it was before? And then the last one I wrote down is consider the story. Consider the story of your career. Consider the story of the product that you're selling, because it's the story that people ultimately buy. And because I recognize that this is sometimes hard for people to do for themselves or something they're selling first, do it for something else. And just ask yourself, what's one of my favorite products that I like to buy? And what is the story behind that product? And that exercise will help push your mind toward that idea of the story of the brand. I'm passionate about Porsche right now. And boy, is there a story behind that and the innovation behind that. And you can also look up JHS pedals and look at their story as well. So those are my three action items. Josh, what's one more principle and action that you'd suggest for people?
Yeah, this is really good. I love your points. I wrote them down. I think
I got them from you.
Yeah. It's such a beautiful thing when you have conversations like this, when there's something about the process of principles going in and out of different people and being reverbalized. It's really cool. So yeah. Even though you got those from me, you're saying stuff through your filter, and it's so valuable because it helps me see the next thing. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, the kick I've been on, a lot of what you heard me say is like, I just kept going. I was passionate about what I was doing. I embraced mistakes. You know, I just kept going and I gave autonomy to people. I found a good team. I embraced what I was good at and I let other people do what I'm bad at. So that's like a summary. But I think the thing that really states it, and I've been really thinking about this a lot and talking about it when I get a chance, is I really, in the last year, have realized how important it is for me to value the process over the product. That's how I've been able to verbalize it. I'm very driven and I would be very focused on the product. And that could be, if you're a band, it might be the song you're writing. If you're me, it's the pedal I'm making. If it's Dave Crenshaw, it might be the book you're working on. There's so much more value for you as a creator in the process than the product. Your products may change the world, but like for you, the journey of that process is so valuable to embrace. Don't rush through it. Just really think about what's happening in your process. Like enjoy it, even the hard parts. Because man, by the time you get your product done, you will have learned so much that your next product, and you just always think about the next. That simple statement is the process is more important than the product. And I've really,
I love it.
I've embraced that big time and it's been helpful. It's been some like mental clarity for me in a lot of situations.
And I love that principle. And I would add, when you focus on the process, the product can't help but come out of it.
That's good.
Yeah. Josh, man, we could talk forever, and I hope we get a chance to talk more in the future. This was a lovely conversation, real pleasure and honor to get to know you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This is a blast.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, do something about what you heard. Just do one small action, and you'll make Josh's story a part of your life forever. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Dave Crenshaw Success Project, hosted by my dad, Dave Crenshaw, and produced by Invaluable Incorporated. Sound editing was done by my brother, Stratton Crenshaw. Research and assistant production by Victoria Bidez. Voiceover by me, Darcy Crenshaw. And the music is by Ryan Brady via Pond 5 licensing. Please subscribe to the Dave Crenshaw Success Project on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. And please don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. See you next time.